Welcome. I'm Angie Coiro. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Just over 73 million Americans tuned in for last night's presidential debate. For comparison, some 160 million are registered to vote. The average episode of Grey's Anatomy, which would run last night, brings in 8.5 million viewers. Analysts and pundits throughout and into this morning have focused more on affect than content, and in that, Donald Trump seems to be the consensus winner. He was energetic and focused, while a much paler and slower-paced President Biden fumbled for words and had some notable gaffes. In fact, this morning you can go online and buy a We Beat Medicare t-shirt. Already you can find arguments for dropping Biden from the ticket with just over 4 months left before the election. Was it really that bad for Democrats? And what about actual debate content? Is that even on the table? We're going over all this with John Nichols and David K. Johnston. John is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation and author of books including The Fight for the Soul of the Democratic Party. Most recently, he co-wrote with Bernie Sanders, It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism. It is always a pleasure to welcome as well Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and author of It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America, and other books. He founded the nonprofit news service DC Report, and his next book is The Prosperity Tax, a new federal tax code for the 21st century economy. David, we'll start with you. How are you?
Just fine.
You are, for real?
I'm back home briefly in Santa Cruz, where I grew up.
Oh, well, that'll help a little bit. Talk a little bit about the way that I summarized the debate, and I want to know how you feel about the accuracy of that and what impressions you took away from it.
Well, I think the biggest concern I have is the awful news coverage of the debate. Donald Trump is an excellent entertainer. Mm. And he knows how to appear before the camera. He knows the camera's always on. And Biden's comm staff clearly failed him. They didn't tell him, don't stand there with your mouth open. Don't look like a deer in the headlights. And don't get into details. And don't be reactive. What Biden should have done in the debate was aggressively gone after Trump for a whole variety of things. Instead, when, for example, the issue of deficits came up, he got lost in the weeds. I doubt that most voters understood or understand today that, yes, Biden has run up deficits, but they're less than half the size of Trump's deficits. Mm. He should have pointed out that on jobs, he's created, even if you exclude the comeback from the pandemic, which was by no means guaranteed to happen. Even if you exclude that, he's creating jobs at a rate twice that of Trump before the pandemic. Mm. And so Biden simply didn't perform well. I think that all this talk that Biden must step out of the race is a very bad reflection on journalism. We're supposed to be in the business of telling you the truth. And, well, emotionally, I understand that response in people. I found the debate very troubling on that level. The facts, and those are what should matter. That is the basis of our democracy, is reasoned and rational debate about reality. On that basis, Trump actually did very badly. Biden did badly in not calling Donald out for what CNN counts as more than 30 lies.
You know, it's interesting. I said to my husband last night after we watched the debate, I said, what really distressed me about going on the air this morning was that in a perfect world, we would be discussing an intellectual confrontation of ideas about how to discuss and how to approach matters of policy.
Exactly. Most people do not vote on that level. I mean, the reality is that people listening to the show, you and I and John Nichols, and we're people who live in this world of policy and we understand it. Most people don't. Donald is a master at reducing things to a visceral level. Joe Biden asked for this debate.
Yes.
At the time he did so, I thought it was a serious mistake because he is the most experienced president we've had since Lyndon B. Johnson, and he is not a debater. And it turns out he made the biggest mistake of his presidency, but I think he can recover from this.
Let me ask you this. If the job of a president is to be prepared and to meet the moment, is it not an indicator that what we saw from Joe Biden last night may well tell us he's not that person?
Oh, I think he's very much that person, but Joe Biden's place of work is the cloakroom in the Senate for more than 30 years in on the phone with people, negotiating with people, you know, with the same margin in the House during his first 2 years that the Republicans had under Trump. They passed numerous major pieces of legislation. We have a booming economy. We are doing vastly better than any other of the G20 nations. We're getting stronger. They're not overall, with, you know, minor exceptions. And so his performance as president has been extraordinary, and it's been that way because he knows Washington. We've had a whole series of amateurs in the White House. Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, who was a senator long enough to have a cup of coffee and announce he was running for president, and he got to the White House thanks to the actress Jeri Ryan, and George W. Bush and Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump accomplished virtually nothing except this massive giveaway to wealthy people. What a Biden should have said last night is, I've cut the deficit more than in half, and if it wasn't for your giveaway to the rich, it would be cut by three quarters or more. He didn't do that. But that doesn't mean he's not qualified. It means debate is not his forum. He is not a public performer like Donald, who's a very, as the most successful con artist in the history of the world, Donald has shown he's a very polished performer. He knows how to look on camera.
As promised, we're going to go to John Nichols, but I want to let you know that your parts of this conversation are important as well. We want your questions and comments about what happened last night. 866-798-8255 is our phone number. 866-798-8255 to bring your questions and comments into this conversation. As promised, John Nichols' overall take on the debate.
My overall take on the debate is it was bad. It was a disaster for Joe Biden. I agree with my friend David K. Johnson that it may not be a career-ending one, but it was a disastrous debate. And it was frankly a disaster for American journalism, for CNN.
Yes.
Because they agreed to and accepted, under the pressure of the moment, under the pressure of how we think about media, how we think about cable news sites and television, to get the access to this debate, they accepted a circumstance in which they surrendered their basic journalistic responsibilities. And so Jake Tapper and Dana Bash, who are very capable people, were essentially news readers, right? They came up with a question. They threw it out there. When the time came, they said time, and then they went to the next question. They didn't follow up in effective ways. They didn't say, hold it. I'm sorry. What you just said is completely false. And they had accepted that model. They had accepted a model that had no fact checking, no challenging of either of the candidates when they said something that was wrong or when they said something that was confusing. So as an example, when Joe Biden said something about, you know, we did in Medicare, right, or something like that, or we beat Medicare. I apologize for paraphrasing. We beat Medicare, right? Any journalist would say, "What do you mean by that?"
Yes.
That's not you know, tipping the balance. That's not putting your thumb on the scale. That is baseline responsibility, and they failed. They left the American people confused. Anybody who's watching that debate, just listening to it, trying to figure out, okay, what's going on here? They didn't know because there wasn't a basic follow-up. And so a lot of people are angry today because there was no fact-checking on Trump's lies. I understand that, and I think that they should never have accepted a situation that allowed one of the biggest liars in American history to have an open platform to do it. But secondly, they also accepted a circumstance where they didn't clarify confusing moments. And so you end up in a situation where if you watched this debate, looking to get a clear sense of where the presidential race is, who these candidates are, you ended up knowing less, not more.
Mm.
That is a total journalistic failure. Is when somebody tunes in to become more informed, they end up being less informed.
You know, I want to go back to that point about CNN, because what was fascinating as this was going on, and I was following this on multiple social media and newsletter channels at the same time it was happening, everywhere I was following it, there was this shadow debate about what the role of a journalist is, with some very respectable voices saying this is what they're paid to do. They're going to ask the questions. They formulated intelligent journalistic questions, and they're going to cut off the mics. Well, you know, I thought the IBM Watson computer could do that and win Jeopardy at the same time.
But, well, you know, in AI,
could
do that, right?
But CNN actually said, and I'm quoting from what the vice president and political director told the Associated Press, the network will not attempt to fact check the candidates in real time, but obviously, this is a direct quote, if there's some egregious fact that needs to be checked or the record needs to be made clear, Jake and Dana can do that. And
they didn't. Yeah, because they are victims, frankly. I'm not beating up on them per se. They're victims of what has become of media in the Trump age. Media outlets have gotten so scared of being accused of being biased, right?
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, the pressure to get a debate. Everybody wants to host a debate, especially the first one. The pressure to get a debate is so warped now that you think, oh, I can't be what Candy Crowley was back in the 2012 debate. Now, I know that's ancient history, but David Kaye will remember this. In the 2012 debate between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, Mitt Romney claimed that when there was a terrorist incident, or when there was an incident that was potentially a terrorist incident, that Barack Obama hadn't said the word terror, hadn't said it was a terrorist incident.
Mm-hmm.
And Barack Obama said, yes, I did. You know, in my first press conference, I mentioned terrorism. And Mitt Romney said, oh, I didn't hear that. Or that's not true, or whatever. And Candy Crowley, as the moderator, said, Mr. Romney, he did indeed say it. Right?
Yes.
That wasn't putting your finger on the scale. That was, you know, there's a confusion here. Do you leave the viewers of that debate confused because there's a conflict over something? Or do you, if you have the information, clarify? That's basic responsibility. That's not, you know, like trying to warp the debate or trying to shape the debate. That is trying to make sure that the viewers have an understanding of what is being discussed. And there's another famous incident back in a 1976 debate, I think, between Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter, where one of the Ford had said something very bizarre about Poland not being, you know, or Poland always being free. And obviously at that time you had the Iron Curtain and stuff. And it was sort of floating out there. And one of the questioners, if I'm right, and we can go back and look at the precise details of this, followed up and said, what do you mean by that? Right.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, Ford's answer wasn't very good. So he didn't really help himself all that much. But at least they did. You know, they followed up in a way that gave him a chance to bring clarity to the situation. And so I understand the debate about the role of a journalist. And I have moderated debates. I believe that and I moderated debates where maybe I kind of felt better about one person who was debating than the other. I guard against that. I've tried to make sure that I'm fair to both. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And part of being fair is to make sure that false impressions and, you know, outright lies, just total fantasies, do not resonate, that they don't implant. That's a part of a journalist's job. That didn't happen. So to recap, and I know I don't want to talk so much because there's so many smart things to explore here, but to recap, Joe Biden had a horrible debate. His campaign, as David Kaye said, his campaign made a terrible mistake in pushing for this early debate, which they didn't do. And it was, you know, it was a self-inflicted wound. There will be a discussion about whether that suggests he is up to the job. You raised that question just a moment ago. All of this is, you know, that's fair game. That's a part of everything. The criticism is a part. We're going to hear a lot of that. Separate and apart from that is the reality that a major news outlet also failed last night. And that failure has had a significant impact potentially on the direction of the race for president of the United States. And we ought to be conscious of both failures now, last night, not simply a Biden failure. There's also a CNN failure.
That's John Nichols. David K. Johnson, let's back up a little bit and talk about the value of the debate in its entirety. Are we missing so far in our conversation anything positive or anything that went well in that debate? Is there something the voters might have benefited from watching that?
Well, there are a lot of things voters might have benefited from if they were well informed. But the undecideds in this election, particularly the independents, and it's about one in six independents who say they're not undecided, those are not high information people. They're not people who think in terms of policy. And so, I mean, I think that John hit it on the head. The debate was a disaster and the news coverage was a disaster. And what this debate illustrated is exactly what the framers of our Constitution were worried about. The reason it's so hard to change things under our Constitution was that the framers were not the founders of the country. There's only about a 20% overlap. The framers were very worried about the public getting wrapped up in something and becoming mob-like in its thinking. And that's what we should be worried about right now, is people responding to this on an emotional, visceral level. Trump is a master as a con artist of getting you to suspend skepticism, to believe in what sounds nice. And Biden is not that kind of person. He is not a debater. Why he asked for this debate, apparently hubris. But no, I don't think anything particularly useful came out of this. And I think what is required now for the Democrats is to really double down a ground game in the seven states that we know are in play. And if there are any other states that turn out they're in play, to go do the same thing, and to not spend money on television ads, which that's how the consultants get paid. They get about 13% of the buy as a commission. Mm-hmm. They need to get a ground game, get people registered, get them to the polls, talk about Dobbs, talk about Project 2025, talk about the Republicans saying we want to end contraception, make it illegal. Certainly, that's not a winning strategy with anybody younger than me. I'm 75. And they need to really hit those things. And Biden needs to be out there pushing these things and dealing with it the way Trump has. These are with visceral issues. You know, when Hillary Clinton ran in 16, she had proposals and she would go, we have this high tech manufacturing, blah, 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 blah. Oh, by the way, footnote 15, blah, 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 blah. And blah, 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 blah. Donald went out there and said, I'm going to create jobs for you. I'm going to get your jobs back. Guess who that resonated with? That's Biden needs to accept the reality that we have in the news business now elevated lies to be on a formal footing with truth. And journalists are the only occupation where we are paid to tell you as best we can the truth. When your doctor says, you know, you got this illness, you're going to die in 6 weeks, he's diagnosing your illness. He isn't getting paid to tell you the truth. He's getting paid to diagnose your illness. We get paid to tell you the truth as best we can. That's based on facts that we can prove. And Donald Trump last night got away with just lying all over the place. John is exactly right about CNN agreeing to this and Biden agreeing to this. This was just malpractice, something the Democrats always have a problem with. The Democrats have a long history of snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
They do. It's remarkable. Let me go to the to one thing we haven't touched on yet, is that amongst all the lies, we were also getting, I can't even call them dog whistles because they were so blatant, the anti-immigrant hate mongering, the blaming everything on the border, linking abortion to undocumented people. Gene Guerrero said in the New York Times that he relied on anti-immigrant hate mongering to cast himself as a defender of black and brown communities. He said they're taking black jobs. They're taking Hispanic jobs. John, one of the funny sidelights was people online speculating on what exactly a black job is. But cutting through that bit of humor, he knows who he's talking to, and he spoke to them very well by underlining the us and them dichotomy.
Sure. Donald Trump is about driving wedges, right?
Mm-hmm.
His vision for how to get elected is to drive enough wedges in the right places, the vulnerable spots around the country, so that he can get not a majority of the votes. And remember, he's never gotten a majority of the votes. He lost to Hillary Clinton by 3 million. He lost to Joe Biden by 7 million. But to get a sufficient number of votes in a sufficient number of battleground states to get him the Electoral College. Or if he doesn't get the Electoral College, to try and get, you know, Brad Raffensperger down in Georgia to find him 11,000 votes and make it happen, right? Mm-hmm. But that's how he thinks about it. And the driving of the wedges is very, very important. Donald Trump is enough of a political watcher that he knows he isn't going to win the black vote in 2024. But his hope is that he can reduce the Democratic percentage, and that's smart politics. I mean, it's not, in this case, how he does it is horrific and indefensible, but the basic concept is that you want to shift enough voters over to your column out of a group that doesn't usually vote for you, that you get an advantage, right? You come out ahead. That's what he was doing last night. It was some of the ugliest and crudest forms of racialized politics that we've seen in a long time, right? Literally trying to drive wedges between immigrant communities and long-term communities, you know, playing on all kinds of dog whistles. You heard it all, and it was called out by very, very savvy commentators from the black community, from the Hispanic community, pundits, etc., all of that. But here's the one thing I'll tell you about the debate setting. That was an ideal setting because of how this debate was set up for Trump to do it. Right?
Yes.
Because he was moving these lies and these wedge issues out at such a rapid rate that it would be impossible for even the most turned on, you know, like young, vibrant candidate in the history of the world to keep up with, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was overwhelming.
In half the time, because the answers were allowed to be 2 minutes long and the rebuttals were allowed to be 1 minute long.
So, right. There's not that. And also, part of the job in a debate, ideally, is to present your own message, not merely to spend all your time trying to address the horrible things the other guy says, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, you have dual responsibilities here. That gets us back to the journalists who are on that stage,
mm-hmm.
right? This is a ripe follow-up question. What do you mean by black jobs? What are you saying here? Right?
Mm-hmm.
And a very fair question. How does this relate to what they used to say about the Irish when they showed up, or the Polish, or the Italians, or, you know, group after group after group, or when black people moved from the South to the North? Always in our history, we have seen efforts to claim that someone was taking somebody else's job. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you doing this now? What is, you know what I mean? That's a legitimate question. Now, would it have been great if Joe Biden brought it up, right?
Yes.
And if he said that was a racist appeal right there, or that was a xenophobic appeal. And he didn't, partially because he had a lousy debate, let's be blunt, but also partially because it's to ask a candidate, even a very, you know, the most capable candidate, to try and keep up with that slurry of lies is an absurdity. And so what you end up with is a situation where Donald Trump knew exactly what he was doing. He knew he was in a setting where, for a variety of reasons, he was going to be able to deliver his blows most effectively. And he knew he wasn't going to be fact-checked in real time. He knew he wasn't going to be challenged with effective follow-up questions. He knew the scenario where he speaks for 2 minutes and then there's a 1 minute rebuttal. He knew all these dynamics. And so he went for it. He went for some of the crudest appeals that you're going to hear in our politics. And shame on the Biden campaign for agreeing to this debate format. Shame on CNN for agreeing to this debate format. Shame on Joe Biden for not being up to some of these answers, right? And we should be honest about that. But shame most of all, let's not deflect from the heart of the matter. Shame most of all on Donald Trump, right? Because this is a candidate for president of the United States who is running a campaign that extends in style and approach from what George Wallace did in the 1960s and 1970s, from what so many of the politicians that we look at, now in horror, right? And mm-hmm. with great disgust. It is Donald Trump who is bringing that politics of reaction, that politics of division forward into now the mid 20th century, 21st century. And that is indefensible. It is inappropriate. And so it is good that we're having this discussion today, because even though it has no equivalence to the debate, it doesn't get the attention or whatever, it is very vital that we do talk about these things and call them out.
And with that, in just a moment, we're going to talk about these calls for Joe Biden to step down. But first, I do want to get to a caller. We've got Sherry in Pinole checking in. Sherry, thanks for listening, and welcome to On the Air.
Hi. I was wondering why Democratic Party resists so much to switch candidates, not only at this time, which I believe it becomes imminent, but also earlier. I've been voted Democrat my life, political life, and I will vote for Biden if I have to. But still, there are so many good candidates out there. Newsom is one, and of course, I'm a fan of Bernie Sanders. And even the age for Bernie doesn't matter. But for some reason, I understand it's about policy. They should highlight more of policy. But the reality out there is that most people, unfortunately, don't, as one of your guests said, don't live in that. They don't go deep. But they see the appearance. And appearance matters.
Yes.
Performance matters. So please try to convince me, because I don't understand why Democrat parties resist to present another candidate. That's very important at this point. Otherwise, we might see Trump win, and that would be a disaster. Thank you.
Thank you, Sherry. Well, you talked us right into it. We're going to talk about what is now a secondary debate. Today's big debate is whether Biden should step down. Mark Leibovich, there's some very respected voices here. Mark Leibovich in The Atlantic said, President Joe Biden needs to end his campaign. He needs to step aside for the sake of his own dignity, for the sake of his party, for the future of the country. This debacle of a debate was a low point. It needs to be a turning point. Robert Kuttner went so far in The Prospect as to talk about the rise of the Nazis. Hitler murdered millions of Jews both as a racial ideologue and as a sociopath. He invited hysterically loyal sociopaths to run his government and carry out his orders. And he uses that to conclude, from Trump to MAGA acolytes in Congress and MAGA state officials, sociopaths are adept at telling big lies, believing those lies, making those lies sound convincing. Though Biden is a truth teller, he's a badly impaired one. He needs to step aside so we are spared being led by our government sociopaths. A number of organs, including The Guardian and Forbes, are already listing potential other candidates. David K. Johnson, tackle this one for us.
Well, Joe Biden is the incumbent president, and unless the incumbent president has turned out to be a disaster, he's always going to be the party's nominee for a second term. And the fact is that Biden has produced the best economy we've had since the 60s. He's investing in the things that have been neglected for more more than a half a century, like our infrastructure, smart programs to bring jobs back from overseas. Not one of the Fortune 100 CEOs supports Trump because they know he's a disaster for business. Trump keeps saying CEOs are backing him, and when you check, they turn out to be relatively minor folks out there. There's, if the Democrats at this point replace Joe Biden, they will lose, and they will lose very badly. You got to go with who you brung to the dance. And this is recoverable. I think Mark Leibovich, a former colleague of mine at the New York Times, is way out there, and a lot of other journalists are, on the basis of this debate, wanting to get rid of Joe Biden. I think that's just terrible journalism, even in opinion journalism, which has been the field I've been in for the last 16 years. Poor judgment, reacting in the moment, and not thinking long term. Now, I've been watching, as we're talking, Joe Biden live on CNN with closed captioning, and he's been delivering all the effective remarks he should have delivered last night. So, the caller, of course the Democrats haven't replaced him. They would replace him if people were unhappy with his performance, and it's been superb.
John?
Look, it's a simple model here. And I've covered a lot of politics for a very long time, and I've written a pile of books about politics. I've written books about Democratic National Conventions, particularly the one of 1944, where Henry Wallace was replaced by Harry Truman. And here's what I will tell you. We need to know the basics up front. The basics up front is that Joe Biden has already won the Democratic nomination. There were primaries across the country. He faced very little opposition through most of that process. Marianne Williamson and Dean Phillips from up in Minnesota ran against him. Pretty much faded after not getting very far in New Hampshire. Then you had the uncommitted campaign, which I've written a lot about, and that's gotten some delegates. But at the end of the day, Joe Biden's got the overwhelming number of delegates committed to him. So if he chooses to continue as a candidate under the structures of the party, that's that. He will be the candidate. And so this takes us to a personal decision, a decision that he still has to wrestle with, right? Mm-hmm. And that the people around him have to wrestle with. And David has made a good case that, you know, he's got a strong record. He is the candidate who's in position, and that simply bouncing him aside because he had a bad debate performance is not something that the party A should do probably, and B that they could do, right? So that's first thing to understand. Now, I'm going to go a different route here, though, and say that last night was a really rough night for Joe Biden. Mm-hmm. It's one that ought to cause him, as a veteran politician, 36 years in the Senate, 8 years as vice president, 4 years as president of the United States, no more experienced politician in the history of the country. As a veteran politician who is in his 80s, he this weekend sit with his wife and his sister and, you know, Ted Kaufman and you know, Ron Klain and other people and talk about this and talk about, you know, that debate and talk about his circumstance. Should they not just go on autopilot but actually have a real deep discussion about this? Yes, of course they could. They should. That's basic responsibility as a leader of an incredibly powerful country, leader of a political party in a very difficult situation, facing a real test of democracy. It's entirely appropriate. And it is appropriate for members of his party, should they want to say, look, you know, we think maybe it's time for you to stand down. That's not wrong. There's nothing that is not unheard of in the past. It is not inappropriate in this moment. It's fine. Now, the interesting thing is, though, that we have a lot of pundits, right? Who are folks in media who are stepping up saying, oh, no, he's got to go, right? Mm-hmm. That's where it gets a little weird, right? I'm interested, and I think that David and you both know, I'm pretty willing to state my view on any issue.
And I'm
pretty blunt about stuff. But in this case, what I'm really interested in is not punditry. I'm interested in what the base of the Democratic Party says, right? What do Democrats say? Democratic grassroots say, what do delegates say? What do members of Congress who are going to be on that ballot this year say? It's okay to have that discussion. It's fine to have a discussion about whether Joe Biden is the right candidate. And if Joe Biden hears that.
Oh, John, I'm sorry. You're breaking up so badly. I'm going to have to cut you off there, John, because we're starting to lose you. And I'm sorry about that. But we need to go to the break nonetheless.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. You came back in long enough to say that, which is I thank you both for a great conversation.
I'm sorry.
No problem. David K. Johnson has been with us, Pulitzer Prize winning investigative reporter. His coming book is The Prosperity Tax, a new federal tax code for the 21st century economy. John Nichols has been with us as well. His most recent book, co-written with Senator Bernie Sanders, is It's Okay to Be Angry About Capitalism, is the national affairs correspondent for The Nation and author of several other books as well. The conversation here on Your Call is not over yet. We're going to take a break and then we're going to move into the influence of AIPAC in the elections. Stick around for that. I'm Angie Cuero. This is Your Call. You are listening to Your Call. I'm Angie Cuero, and for Rose, who's taking the day off, we move now to, well, more of the debate and as well the influence of AIPAC in the elections, spending nearly $15 million on this Bowman-Latimer race that, it ended with the squad's Bowman having to bow out. Bronco Matschich is staff writer at Jacobin and the author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. It's very good to have you back. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Well, let me, before we move on to the topic of AIPAC, I'm sure you heard the end of our conversation with John and David, and I want to take the same over to you with the convention looming in Chicago. What are your impressions of what you saw last night and about the question of whether Joe Biden may have put the period on the end of his campaign?
My impression watching it in real time was it was a disaster. I felt that he probably lost it within 11 minutes when he gave the answer about the national debt, where he trailed off and said something nonsensical about beating Medicare. But there were so many different moments. I mean, the inability to formulate a coherent point on abortion, which is the strongest issue that Democrats have and the weakest one for Trump, and Biden at one point seemed to lend credence to Trump's claim that you know, babies in blue states are being killed after birth.
Mm-hmm.
And Biden said, well, that's only in the case of the mother's health. He took one abortion question and he pivoted to an answer about the woman who was killed by an undocumented immigrant, which is not only irrelevant, but also on a political level, taking the strongest issue for him and moving to the absolute weakest issue. But it was emblematic of the entire performance, which is just Biden was not able to formulate a coherent answer to a lot of things. He got a little bit better as it went on, but by that point it was too late, and it didn't get much better. And I mean, I have to say that when I hear people saying that, you know, actually this performance doesn't matter, Biden's doing a great job, people are satisfied, I mean, this does a disservice to both Biden and the Democratic electorate. The problem with this entire issue has been that Democrats, people in the media, people who have been around Biden, who have now, you know, exploded with all these op-eds talking about how he needs to step down, the entire issue is that they have not been honest about what they've been seeing. And they've thought that if they can just talk about how bad Trump is, and obviously Trump is, you know, also incoherent and terrible in his own particular ways. But the thought was that if they can just focus on Trump, if they can ignore Biden's difficulties in public appearances, that would be enough, that would make the public stop worrying about Biden's age and about his fitness in office. And that hasn't worked. And it's led up to this moment where finally people were able to, you know, the entire U.S. public, the voting public was able to watch Biden in real time, not without any editing, not without any kind of doctoring of videos. They saw him in real time. And that was what Biden always said. He said, watch me, watch me. And they watched him. And as I think it was Chuck Todd of NBC said, I mean, he kind of confirmed or appeared as the caricature that conservative media paints him as. And I think continuing to just brush this under the rug, it's not going to make this issue better. Somebody high profile, someone prominent needs to come forward and you know, say something. Because I think last night we saw this could very well be a disaster for the Democrats and, you know, potentially for the entire country.
I do want to acknowledge we have left some callers waiting on the line. I want to get at least one of those before we change our topic here. Pam is calling in. Pam, I appreciate your waiting. What are your thoughts here?
What I wanted to let everyone know is in Heather Cox Richardson's email this morning, she describes a technique, a rhetorical technique of gaslighting called Gish Gallop.
Yes.
And it's a technique in which someone throws out a fast string of lies, non sequiturs, and specious arguments so quickly it's impossible to fact check, and the opponent can look confused and have it difficult to grapple with. And what she says is it's a form of gaslighting that is especially effective for somebody with a stutter, like Mr. Biden, to respond to. And she postulates that is part of what we were observing when we observed the debate last night.
Boy, there's a reason she's a national treasure, and I appreciate you bringing that up. In fact, it turns out we have David K. Johnson still with us, which I'm very pleased to hear, so we can have both of you on at the same time. David, that rhetorical technique works very well, and it goes hand in hand with, you know, a lie goes around the world twice before the truth has time to get its pants on. So that's part of what we're seeing being relied on here as a rhetorical device. David? Oh, David is not still with us, so I'll take that over to you, Bronco.
Certainly there was a lot of that. I mean, Trump lies and lied relentlessly and said some incredibly shockingly racist things. One of which comes to mind immediately was when he, as a derogatory comment, called Biden a Palestinian. So there was plenty of that. But I really have to insist that people need to be clear-eyed about this, and they need to snap out of a sense of self-denial. Biden is an experienced politician and debater. He was palpably worse in that debate than he was 4 years ago against Trump. And I would invite people to watch his debates from 2012. Biden, this is not remotely the same man that he was when he was vice president, when he dismantled Paul Ryan very yes. capably. Secondly, while even if we want to, you know, for argument's sake, say that Biden was simply bamboozled by this kind of string of lies and he found it difficult to form a coherent thought. That in itself is not a very good argument, because this is what's going to happen if you're debating against Trump, and frankly, any politician, but particularly Trump. Biden's entire case is that he is the one who is most capable of defeating Trump and protecting American democracy. And yet, what we are doing now is we are finding excuses to explain away and sort of accommodate Biden's inability to do that when he's proving himself actually incapable of challenging Trump, of beating him. I mean, you know, I think watching last night, I was just thinking to myself, this is such a gift to the Trump campaign, because it appears to confirm so many of the criticisms that they have made of Biden, and it confirms or appears to confirm many of the alarms, and those go across partisan lines, that people have about Biden and his fitness for office. So I think if we really care about the future of American democracy, if we really care about the future of things like climate change, migrants' rights, workers' rights, I think there needs to be an end to this self-imposed taboo within the Democratic Party to not discuss honestly Biden's issues, and to you know, make a course correction before it's too late, because there's still plenty of time. If by the next debate in September he's still is as bad as he was in this debate, or even worse, you know, at that point, it's going to be pretty hard to do anything about that.
Understood. We are going to move on to talk about AIPAC. And for those who are not familiar, it's a lobbying group, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, very much involved in the election, spending at least $14.5 million in the race with Jamal Bowman, who's a member of the Progressive Squad, defeated in his primary election by pro-Israel Westchester County Executive George Latimer. And it's even reported that George Latimer was essentially drafted because he's pro-Israel, urged by Jewish leaders to challenge Bowman's critical stance on the war in Gaza. So fill us in on the blanks in that one, Bronco, and talk about whether this is emblematic of what's happening in other races with AIPAC's influence.
Well, the race between Latimer and Bowman is very much, you know, a microcosm of a wider battle happening within the Democratic Party. And it's a battle that really should alarm anyone who is or considers themselves a committed Democrat who believes in the values that the party stands for. Because what AIPAC has done, the strategy that they have devised, they and other, you know, pro-Israel forces since 2021, is to defeat progressive candidates, although not always progressive candidates, any candidates that have even mild criticisms of Israel and Israeli policy towards the Palestinians. They have started to use the opening up of U.S. elections to massive amounts of big money spending to basically just inundate these Democratic primaries with negative ads about the candidates that they don't like, that they want to defeat, as never actually mention Israel, because AIPAC and these other groups realize that if you actually look at where public opinion stands, particularly within the Democratic Party, their position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is not shared by the electorate that they try to sway. So what these ads do instead is they present a very distorted, misleading picture of the person's record. They'll often play on the idea that these are disloyal Democrats, these progressives, that they are trying to undermine President Biden as agenda, that they are incompetent, not serious about legislating, and so on and so forth. And that they're kind of scary and radical. They have all sorts of crazy ideas that make them unfit for office. And that was basically the attack line that was used during this Latimer Bowman race, where the ads and Latimer himself, they used things like the scandal that Jamal Bowman had around pulling the fire alarm in the middle of a House session, for which he ended up pleading to a misdemeanor over. And they used his vote against the infrastructure bill, which in reality was not actually a vote against the bill. It was a vote to maintain the legislative strategy that the Democratic leadership had devised to keep the infrastructure bill and the massive expansion of social spending that was going to be the centerpiece of Biden's presidency, to keep those things together. But it was taken out of context, and they said, you know, he betrayed Biden and he voted against the infrastructure bill. And that created this image of him that was particularly potent in the wealthier areas of Westchester that were part of Bowman's district, that, you know, he just wasn't a serious legislator, that he wasn't someone that the party could count on, even if he wasn't actually disliked by the voters. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the other thing to really bring up here is that, you know, AIPAC, it's Super PAC, United Democracy Project, that spent, this is the most expensive House race in history. I think UDP spent alone $15 million to get Latimer elected and to make all these attack ads against Bowman. I mean, the funding from that has come largely from Republican donors. And, you know, I spoke to Democrats and activists and people who are, you know, within the Democratic Party about this. And you know, their point was, look, I'm a Democrat. I don't want Republicans to be able to influence my party and who ends up getting elected. But that is exactly what is happening right now. And this playbook that AIPAC has created is not going to stay limited to AIPAC. Other corporate interests are going to figure out, hey, wait a minute, we can also just flood the airwaves with negative ads against whatever candidate we don't like so that we can get a more Republican-friendly candidate into office.
This is really, it's distressing. I want to draw people's attention to your investigation in these times, corporate power brokers behind Apex War on the Squad. I hate to ask you this with so little time remaining, but I think it's very important with what's happening in Gaza. It's been a long time that AIPAC and others have pushed the idea that to be against what's happening in Gaza is to be against Jewish people, that you must be anti-Semitic in order to object to what's been happening in Gaza. Is that carrying less water? Are people starting to question that now?
I think people are. I think, number one, the main reason why is these protests across the country, but not just in the United States, around the world, have actually been organized and led by Jewish activists, Jewish anti-war activists who are appalled by what they've been seeing in Gaza, who are appalled by the idea of and the sight of Israeli officials saying that the war crimes and various human rights abuses that they are committing is for the benefit or behalf of all Jews everywhere, which is itself an anti-Semitic idea. And so I think people are realizing, wait a minute, there's a difference between criticizing the Israeli government, between the policies of a far-right government, and criticizing Jews, because many Jews are opposed to what they're seeing, because they have a historical commitment to justice. So I think people are starting to question that. I think those attacks don't carry as much weight as they used to. However, unfortunately, it takes a long time for people's minds to change. It takes a long time for some of these shifts to happen. So I think even though it carries less water than it used to, that is still a powerful accusation. And that's why you see it being basically, I think, irresponsibly bandied about so much right now, to the point where even Jews have been accused of being anti-Semites for criticizing Israel.
Right through the looking glass, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time, and I do draw people's attention to your article there, and we'll link that on our website as well. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks very much for having me.
And thanks, too, to our earlier guests, John Nichols and David K. Johnson. Bronco McTeach, pardon me, is a staff writer at Jacobin, author of Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. Malihi Raz is on produced today's show. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Angie Carter in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us on Your Call.
The Bay Area's Got Talent, and KALW is here to showcase it. Come join us the final Friday of each month at our live event space in downtown San Francisco for an open mic. Musicians, poets, storytellers, all welcome. Discover some of the hidden gems in our midst. That's this evening starting at 5:30, and it's free. Food and drinks available for donation to KALW. It's happening at 220 Montgomery Street, just two blocks from the Montgomery Street BART and Muni Station. Find more info at KALW.org. See you tonight.